like to call the meeting to order, and if you'd rise for the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Please be seated. First thing I'm going to do is welcome a few people to our meeting. We have invited Senator Bill Posey to be here. We've invited Representative Thad Altman to be here. And several others who I don't know if they're arrived or not. I'll find out in a minute. Somebody's pointing back there. As you know, we're coming up on an election, and we wanted you to have a chance to meet a few of these people, see what they look like, hear what they stand for, and I'm going to give each one of them 2 minutes. That's my objective. And with that, first of all, I'd like to introduce Senator Bill Posey.
Campaign speech for 2 minutes?
2 whole minutes.
Okay. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah.
All right. I was coming here just to kind of tell you about what we did these past couple of years for your legislation. I didn't understand we were going to actually be able to campaign, but I am Bill Posey, and I'm running for Congressional District 15, and I'm running to try and bring some reform to the federal government. Now, that was my goal, I said, when I was first elected to the Florida House in 1992. People thought I was crazy. People said, oh, that'll never happen. You'll never do that. Well, it took 8 years, but I did it. And the American Legislative Exchange Council, a bipartisan organization, called it the best legislation to come out of any state in over a decade. And on other tough issues, elections reform, you remember I did that after the 2000 fiasco. Medical malpractice insurance, workers' compensation insurance, and yes, property insurance, I'm the one my colleagues turn to because I've got a track record of getting the tough jobs done. I've served honorably, and I've worked hard to earn the respect of you and my colleagues. In over 15 years, I've missed 3 days of work. I've run my office under budget every single month, returning taxpayer dollars to the state coffers, your money, every single month. I'm trying to bring the same kind of common sense reforms to Washington that I brought to Tallahassee. Now, on a side note, I have enjoyed working with your representative, Harry Charles, the last couple years. We've reported to you a couple times some of the accomplishments that we've had. I was honored to receive your Legislator of the Year award last year. Now, you're going to be fortunate today to hear from Pete Dunbar, someone else who represents you on the ground in Tallahassee. But before then, I just want to take a couple minutes. On behalf of the entire Brevard County Legislative Delegation, Representative Altman, Representative Sasso, those that aren't here, to recognize Harry for some of the work that he has done on your behalf. He has saved this state millions, I mean millions of dollars. And he has saved you, each, individually and collectively, an awful lot. And we have a special recognition that we give people that really do that. We call it Quality Floridian. And we're honored today to be able to give Harry Charles the Quality Floridian Award. Harry? That goes with this that tells about this award, the history of this award. It's a very, very prestigious award. Now, at the same time, I'm going to tell you now, I'm probably over my 2 minutes. I get 30 seconds extra, but it's not about me.
All right.
Okay? When I was first elected in 1992, manufactured homeowners were really getting abused. The park owners, once they got the people settled down, they said, well, here's the way the rates are going to be structured. As soon as they sold out from that boom, the rates started going up. I mean skyrocketing. And there was a something on the ground for you up there. And Pete, what you did this year was nothing less than exemplary. And on behalf, come up here, Hewitt, on behalf of the Brevard County Legislative Delegation and all its members, we want to reward you with what we call our Exemplary Service Award for what you have done for our condominium owners in the state of Florida, and more particularly in the Space Coast. Thank you, Pete.
I think Pete is too. Thank you, Bill. We all appreciate what you have done for us over the years. He's sponsored a bill last time, this year. Thad Altman co-sponsored a bill. We've had great support. I would like to introduce Thad Altman. You also may have 2 minutes, Thad.
Okay, thank you. Well, I first want to thank each and every one of you for your public service. You know, I've been a county commissioner, I've been a state legislator, but I think the toughest job I have was I served 3 years on the condominium board in Atlanta. And you are public service. You're here on your Saturday morning serving your constituents. And I know the pay, I've been there, doesn't have a whole lot of pay, so not if you're doing it right. But I just want to take this opportunity to recognize Harry Charles. You know, Harry Charles is a treasure to the state of Florida. He is a treasure to Brevard County. Selfless service, never complains, has a get-do attitude. He is a giver, not a taker. And I tell you, Harry, I can't thank you enough. It's people like you that make this a great state. I mean that in all sincerity. I've worked in public service for 15 years, and I don't think I've ever worked with an individual who has given more, more professional, more positive. I could use all the accolades I could think of, but Harry, you're top notch. And Pete Dunbar, you have served the Condominium Association as well. There's no one in Tallahassee who does it any better. You know, it's a tough process up there, and there's a lot of conflicting interests. Not all of them have good motivation, and it's good people like you that serve your time, that bring the professionals to help assist our elected officials to do the right thing, and I just thank you so much for that. Senator Posey has been a joy. I've worked with Senator Posey now for 6 sessions. We've done innumerable bills together. He's an incredible advocate for Brevard County, a selfless public servant, and I'm going to miss him in Tallahassee, but he's going to be a great addition to Washington for the Space Coast. I serve in the Florida House, as Harry mentioned, but I'm running for Senator Posey's job, his Senate seat. I got some big shoes to fill, but he's mentored me for 6 years, so I'm ready. But I'd love your support there. But again, Harry, Pete, and all of you for the service. You know, having served on the condo board and in the Atlantic, I appreciate what you're doing. So important to our community. But thank you for allowing me to be here.
Thank you. Representative Tony Sasso is here, and I invited him also to have 2 minutes with you. Tony.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Right here?
You'll be welcome.
Okay. Good morning, everyone.
You'll pick up where we are.
First of all, I just want to, again, mirror what my colleagues have said. I started out years ago.
Apparently, there are a lot of.
As a homeowner association president. So be careful what you do here.
Before you introduce,
many of you know me. See a lot of familiar faces out here. I got started here in Cocoa Beach as a city commissioner. Remember, several years ago, we had some issues on road management. That sort of got me involved in local politics. It grew from there. But one of the things that I found through that whole process was Harry. Harry was always there. When we passed the height and density proposals,
sort of get together so easily because I'm an engineer, Harry's an engineer, and we understand that it's just really getting down to nuts and bolts and making it happen in the best way possible. And that's what my colleagues do up in Tallahassee. That's what Harry does for us. And Pete, I know that that's something that we're going to work on in the future. So I want to just say thank you to all of you. God bless you, Harry. You're just a joy to work with. I really appreciate it. I look forward to more years working with you. So thank you very much for what you do. And thank you all for what you all do.
Thank you, Tommy. Here. Okay. First of all, if you have some written questions, please take the cards with those questions to the back of the room and give them to any of several board members and so forth so that we can get them organized. Let's tell you briefly about our membership. We have three new associations as members. If anyone is here from the associations, please let us know. Country Woods Village Condo, Seaton by the Sea, Woodside. Stand up. Hey. Welcome. We're glad you're members. Businesses, we have Boats Plumbing, Custom Roofing, First Coast Studies. As you can see, businesses normally don't come to the run-of-the-month programs. Horschel & Sons Roofing, Robert Dean Friedman, there he is. Welcome, Robert. Thomas K. Realty and United Railing. I'm going to give Paul about a minute, please, no more than that, to tell what he does. Would you, Paul?
My name is Dean Friedman, and I'm a long-term care planner in Brevard County. Long-term care affects everybody in some way, and I feel like it's my mission to educate the public on long-term care, how to plan for it, how to fund it so it doesn't affect your assets in retirement. And on the back table is a proposal to actually come out and do a workshop. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think I called him Paul. His name is Robert Dean. And we have one individual, Nancy Marshall. With that, we have a total of 17 individuals. We have 142 businesses. We have 266 associations with 19,548 units. Clay, may we have a treasurer's report, please?
Sweet, because I know that you're here to hear Pete, not me, but got some good news this time. If you've been attending regularly, you know we've been in negative territory in terms of income and expenses for the year, but we're now back in positive territory by about $2,500. All our bills are current and paid, and we have, in combination of money market accounts and checking account, about $37,798 on hand. So we're solid and doing well, and thanking you for your faithful dues payment that lets us do those things.
Thank you. Several announcements. Our next program will be on October the 4th. The underlying theme of that one, as of several of them, is disaster mitigation. The next program is going to be on the legal and insurance obligations. You know, suppose you have major damage to the buildings. What are you supposed to do? What can you do legally? What do you have to check on in your insurance? What does your insurance require you to do or cover or what have you? And so we're going to have Lou Byron, who is one of my handful of favorite agents, been doing this for over 30 30 years and a very impressive guy. And we have Paul Ween. I think all of you have seen Paul in the past on programs. And the two of them will cover that program. In case you haven't discovered it already, I want you to know that we have the new 718 available in the back of the room. Florida Statute 718 is the Condominium Act. If you live in an HOA, pick up a copy anyway, because Representative Julio Rubino has said that this next year he's going to reform HOAs just as he did condos this year. And believe me, you don't want all that. And so take a copy and you can see the sorts of things that happened this year. I want to mention a fire safety campaign that's statewide. The hotel and restaurant people in Tallahassee, along with the fire marshals throughout the state, are very frankly trying to require you to put sprinklers in your units. We have a provision 718 where most of you can opt out of it. They had a meeting in Tallahassee to try to figure out some way to get around this paragraph, this statement in 718. And they were told it wasn't anyway. 718 does prevail. But they're doing a number of things. They are defining transient public lodging establishments and non-transient public lodging establishments. And I don't understand all the rules on this in spite of the hours I've spent on it. There's been a number of those, and we've had several meetings on it as well. But if they can establish that you are a transient lodging facility, according to their definition, they can treat you like a hotel and have the hotel requirements, as far as Statute 509, I believe it is, apply. So watch out for it. The most important piece of advice I can give you is to make sure that your owners rent their units for at least 30 days. Now, if your documents already provide for something less than 30 days, I can't help you. But most documents specify 30 days minimum or some longer period of time as a minimum. Make sure that your owners know that they've got to rent these places for 30 days or more, or the whole association is in danger of being classified as a hotel, is what it amounts to. We'll get more into that later on. Not today, but I wanted you to know what's going on because it's so terribly important. The next President's Forum, I believe it's going to be September the 13th. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
September the 13th. Regular place, it's a meeting room in my condominium, Royal Towers. If you haven't been there before, call either Beverly or Jackie or see them and they can tell you where more details about it. Then let's get to our program. The program is a legislative update. You probably know that we are working very hard this year to get some good things passed, to stop some bad things from being passed. There's no way in the world that we could have gone as far as we did without Pete Dunbar doing the actual work in Tallahassee. Pete, Ed sponsored a bill also related to this. Pete did yeoman's work. I refer to him as a magician. I think he heard about it. It's true. He helped tremendously to help pass the things we want to pass and to try to prevent the bad things from becoming law. Now, you'll find in the 718 that there's some things that you consider to be very bad still, some things I consider to be very bad. They would have been far worse if Pete Dunbar had not been working on the problem. You've all seen Pete before, you know him, you're probably get tired of hearing me say all the things that he's done. He worked for a couple of governors, he helped write the majority of the laws. In fact, I refer to something in an email to him and said, I thought it was 1991. He said, yeah, that's right. And I had the benefit. I had it in writing somewhere. He has spoken to Space Coast a number of times. He's a law professor. In fact, I know he's got some copies of 718 for his class in law school. He's probably the best expert on association law that I know of. And I'm extremely impressed that he drove down yesterday through that storm to be here. In fact, we gave him an out in case Casey thought it was too dangerous, we'll cancel it. We'll do it again another time. But he, without any hesitation, he said that he would be here Saturday morning, and he is here. And with that, it's my pleasure to give you Pete Dunbar.
Stand by, we're going to get you wired up. Okay, this is for the house now.
Have me ready in a minute. Whoops, which one is that? That obviously is for the room. This one's for the, this is for the tape. Yeah, don't go through the airport. That's a good line. That's a good one. Drive through 5 hours of rain yesterday, and it interests me only because I was on the ballot personally 6 times, that today is the weekend before our primary vote, and I'm glad that we had the opportunity to hear from Bill and from Thad and from Tony. I want to digress just a minute to share with you that the dynamics of the legislative process involve 160 people in Tallahassee. Things don't happen unless there are people willing to listen and to do things. To my good friend Bill Posey, I can't thank you enough for all the time and effort that you make available to me on behalf of everyone here, particularly in these last couple of years where you have chaired that very important committee. And damn, Bill, we're going to miss you. But you are going to be a great congressman. And I will segue into the fact that hopefully we are leaving this in very good hands. My friend Thad Altman has been just amazing for us. He has been one of our go-to people in the House. He is the sponsor of the bill, as was Bill Posey, of some of the things we're going to talk about later today. Thad, we're going to welcome you to the Senate. I'm glad you're not going anywhere else. And finally, to Tony, you will appreciate this. And Tony, I know when I was doing this, every 2 years, you know, you had a little bit of lead-up time for you. It's happening a little quicker this time. But through a mutual friend, Ron Greenstein, he had not been in Tallahassee, I believe, more than a couple of weeks before he and I met. He became, you know, that interaction so that we would know, have an ability to communicate with him on the issues that affect you in community housing living. And Tony, I'm looking forward to working with you in the next session. And this is a great group, and there's lots of things to do. having said all of that, I also want to observe that I've now spent about 42 years in the legislative process with one hat or another on. This is one of those rare years in community living where we have seen more changes than in almost 20 years. I'm going to go through them by bill number and try to highlight the important parts of them for you. And I'm also going to comment on some of our legislative guests and their role in helping us get a lot of this done. And as Harry mentioned, avoid a lot of the potential problems that were in some of these bills early on in the process. There is a brief summary that Harry asked me to prepare. You have it. It will give you something to refer back to. And I will apologize a little bit in advance because, unlike my other presentations, we're going to go through a lot of material quickly. I will try to hit the highlights, and if you have specific questions on parts of them, I'm willing to stay, as I usually do, for as long as you have questions. As Harry said, it will help us if you will write them down. That will help us avoid or organize those that are sort of duplicates. It will also let me restate the questions concisely for everybody's benefit. I want to give a little bit of predicate to what these changes are because, as I mentioned, there are quite a few. And there are a number of factors that were catalysts to the changes that we're going to go over. First, I think it's quite clear that the role of community associations is expanding. It is becoming more visible. And as a result, there is now becoming a closer scrutiny that those tasks and responsibilities are performed correctly. And it's also apparent in some areas that there are deficiencies in those operations, some real, some perceived, but that also creates an additional focus on what we do and how the laws will govern us. We had a select committee that was chaired by Representative Julio Urbina, spent quite a bit of time in Southeast Florida, and they did discover some most unusual problems. Anecdotally, we may touch on some of those later on. But that became part of the foundation for this group of sweeping changes that we see. The second reason that brought about a lot of these is typified by Tropical Storm Fay. I talked to my wife this morning. She's been out without electricity for the last 14 hours. And goes, where are you? And I went, well, I'm down here. I got electricity and air conditioning. But the 2004 and 2005 storm seasons in particular created a huge new focus on the insurance components of the law, particularly as they relate to condominium associations. And one of the things that we're going to get into a little bit later on is there was a wide divergence on what insurance world and law provided versus what condominium law mandated on each of you that are community leaders. And they didn't match up very well, and they had communities underinsured, boards exposed for not keeping up with their appropriate duties, and all of that has contributed to some of the changes. By the way, on this particular one, you can thank Senator, soon-to-be Congressman Posey, and Representative, soon-to-be Senator Altman, for helping us clean up major parts of that area of the law. The final factor for this year's sort of legislative changes revolve around the Division of Land Sales, Condominiums, and Mobile Homes, now known as the Division of Condominiums, Mobile Homes, and Timeshares. Several changes have been modified, have been made to specifically modify or overrule positions that the division had taken concerning communities, particularly condominium communities. Other changes were made to help the division do their job better and to help them better serve communities and provide a more meaningful role in what we do. Some of the changes I'm about to touch on are going to affect your day-to-day operations without question. Many of the others, I think, will have limited impact on how you do with your daily business in your community, and I will try to acquaint you with all of them so that you're able to evaluate which are appropriate for you and which are not. How many mandatory homeowners associations are there in the room? I have a few. All right, well, let me do, there are some changes that happened in that arena, and let me go through those quickly. I want to begin first with House Bill 601. There are a number of changes in that bill, and I'm going to deal with many of the others later. But be aware that the first one creates a new procedure for providing estoppel certificates. That means when I am a homeowner and I want to sell and I ask the association, what's the payoff or what's the status of my assessments, you are required to provide that information. This now provides that the manager can provide that, charge a reasonable fee for that, provided that the authority to do so is granted in writing by the board, and it then becomes the responsibility of the homeowner to pay that reasonable charge when the sale closes or when the refinancing occurs. If the closings fall through, the homeowner will pay for it in the next sequence of assessment payments. So that's in 601. If you are an association that governs townhomes, now this doesn't really apply to you if it's a single family home subdivision, be aware of House Bill 727. It amends a portion of the state's fire code, specifically section 633.022, and requires specific posting of signage when the buildings are built of truss type construction. This is a fire protection measure for the emergency service personnel, fire, other emergency personnel that's responding to a disaster, to let them know that the roof may collapse. This is a nationwide effort that's going on. It is a direct result of things that happened not in Florida but in two other states that created injury and death to some firefighters. Boards with fiduciary duties, remember, this is now an affirmative obligation to warn. If you don't post the signage correctly and somebody gets hurt responding to a fire in your community, that is potential problems for you. So be aware of the new posting requirement. In homeowners associations, you probably will not encounter the next change. I hope you're not going to, but be aware that House Bill 1105 by Representative Rivera now provides for the option to create and petition for a receiver if you do not fill vacancies on the board of directors. It requires specific notice requirements that a homeowner is intending to do that, and actually if the receivership is granted, it requires a second notice by the judge that has occurred, and then, of course, the homeowners associations, through the dues of the owners, will be paying for the cost of the receivership, including the receiver's salary. There is a new privilege that's been extended to homeowners in an association in Senate Bill 1378. You can have a flagpole in your yard and fly the American flag or the flags of branches of the armed services. Whether the documents or the policies of the community prohibit it or not, those are now overridden, and the only restrictions that remain are those which appear in the bill itself. They do things like limit the pole height to 20 feet and some other things. But be aware that that's out there as well, and if it may apply in your community, you may want to be aware of it. Finally, in community associations, there is a bill by Senator Ring. This is Senate Bill 1986 that modifies the notice procedures that passed in 2007 concerning the collection of delinquent assessments. Last year, we have a 45-day period before the lien can be filed, an additional 45-day period before the foreclosure can be filed. That has been clarified. The time periods remain the same, and there are now notices for the delinquent homeowner to protest, and there is a form for providing the qualifying offer to settle the dispute and pay the costs and delinquent fees. I want to touch briefly on something that did pass but was vetoed by the governor, and that is House Bill 679. This is the one that had a majority of the big changes in it for homeowners associations. I think driving this piece of legislation had several factors, but one is that boards and community associations, homeowners associations in particular, are perceived to not understand their duties in many places, and as a result, members in those communities are not having their rights adequately protected. The bill was vetoed because of a swimming pool exemption, not because of any of the other things that are in the bill, and as Harry has already mentioned, expect this bill to be back again on steroids. There's lots of, and a lot of those steroid-induced items are going to be the things that pass this year in condominiums. Good idea to pick up the booklet, as Harry mentioned, because you will probably see some of them. Let me mention to you what I think they will be based on the discussions I've already heard. New penalties for board members who violate the provisions of the homeowner's law, including potential criminal penalties. Certification requirements for newly elected board members. We'll talk about that a little bit in for condos in a minute. There are, I'm quite sure, going to be new dispute resolution mechanisms put in place. I think there is a very good chance that that will include mandatory non-binding arbitration. That's the way we do it in condos. That appears to be on the table and was a part of the other bill. I expect new restrictions on how homeowners associations contract for goods and services. I also expect that there will be new disclosure requirements in the event that the party that the association is contracting with has any financial arrangements with a board member or officer. Further protections from architectural control decisions made by boards and architectural review committees. New election procedures. See us move closer potentially to the way we do it in condos. And finally, there is continuing advocacy that there needs to be some kind of state regulation of mandatory homeowners associations. I do expect that to be a topic. I do not expect that to pass. Homeowners associations. We'll leave that for the time being. Let me now turn to condominiums. And beginning with condominiums, let me return to House Bill 727. This is the posting requirement for truss-type construction that amends Section 633022. Again, the posting to protect the firefighters and other emergency service personnel that are responding to your community to warn them of the truss-type construction and the potential of collapse. It's important you comply with this new requirement if your community is affected. I would strongly recommend, and by the way, this bill took effect on July the 1st. You should already be posted if you're affected by it. What I would recommend that you do is immediately get with your local fire officials to make sure that they help you get this done correctly and you have met your fiduciary duty both to your community and to those that will be entering on the property. Let me next move to the Comprehensive Energy Bill. Legislature had quite a good piece of legislation to deal with energy conservation this year. That is committee substitute for House Bill 697. It's a big bill, but in it, there are two provisions kind of buried down in there that if you're in a condominium community, you will want to know about. The first provision authorizes the Board of Directors to install solar panels or solar collectors on the common elements for the benefit of the community, and it is not considered a material modification or alteration to the property, and no vote of the unit owners is required. I might mention that parenthetically, while that is probably a good expression and typically how we would operate in condominium communities, this language also overrides a district court of appeals case where a unit owner went into the roof, common elements, installed skylights, thinking that was an energy-saving arrangement, and the association could not stop them because of what the law had said prior to this change. What we've also done by authorizing it to be done by the board is return to the board control of the common elements so individual unit owners can't go whacking around in the walls and ceilings of the condominium property. The second change relating to solar panels will apply to you only if your condominium is basically a land condominium, and it allows for the unit owner to install solar panels within the boundaries of their unit. Now, if you're a typical community where it's the unfinished wall, unfinished ceiling, unfinished floor, no reason to be installing solar panels. But if the boundaries of your condominium unit are basically a lot line and you have some yard, you can now install those solar panels within your own yard, no matter what the community documents say. Okay, let's go to the big bill, or the first big bill, the biggest of the big bills. And That is Community Substitute for House Bill 995 by Representative Rubina. This bill is 87 pages long. You will find that my summary is not nearly that long, but hopefully it will highlight the key parts of it that you will need to include. A couple things. This is already now included in the yellow books that you picked up. But it does not take effect until October 1st. So be a little sensitive if you're trying to do something here in the next 6 weeks that some of these changes haven't taken effect yet. And I'll mention them by category to let you know. Basically, it breaks down into 9 major areas. I'm going to try to run through them in categories. If you have specific questions, I'll be more than happy to deal with them during question and answers. And I will also say parenthetically that the working group of which Harry participated and others from Space Coast, when this bill started, I can't tell you how not good it was. I would guess that there were more than 6 dozen individual changes to this bill before it got into the form that it is. It also ended up getting a number of very good provisions added to it that were in other bills, part of them coming from Senator Posey's bill, things that the Space Coast and other groups around Florida had worked on. Finally did make it into the bill, and when it was done, as Harry mentioned, there are a couple of rough spots that I think we'd all like to see changed, but in large measure, it has turned out to be a pretty good piece of legislation. Let me run through the categories for you. First, in the general association operation, there are 5 or 6 changes, and they include the elimination of the alternative method for voting on board members. Up until this year, or up until October the 1st, in your bylaws, you could provide an alternative to the way most of us ballot in our communities. That is no longer available to communities that have 11 units or more. The alternative is still available to the very small communities, but no longer to everyone else. We have also eliminated the right to vote a unit voting interest that is owned by the association. So if the association owns a manager's unit or has taken a unit back in foreclosure, that unit no longer is eligible to vote in any election or for any purpose. I might parenthetically note this grows out of an abuse in South Florida where elevator shafts and storage areas were units. Well, it's done, trust me. And that was a way that the association board of directors could perpetuate itself, and that was an abuse perceived by Representative Rubina, I think correctly perceived. So no longer do those storage areas, elevator shafts and things, count as votes, those if they are defined as units. A lot of these, by the way, show up in what's known as a hotel condominium. Also in administration, association administration, there is a new privilege for the unit owners to petition by 20% of the community to have an item put on the agenda of the board. If the 20% threshold is achieved, the board must, at the next regular or special meeting, agenda the item and consider it and dispose of it. If you waive your reserves, there is new disclosure language which is required on your limited proxy. Spelled out right there in the statute. Make sure you don't miss it, otherwise your waiver may be ineffective. The law doesn't say this precisely, but I would also recommend to you that if you use a ballot as well as a limited proxy, you should have the disclosure language there as well. Also in administration, meetings must be held within 45 miles of the community. I'm not aware of anybody going to Georgia to have a meeting. Most of them are held within that all the ones I know of are. But be aware, if you're tending to, you know, head down to Marathon to have your annual meeting, can't do that anymore. It must be within 45 miles of the community. And one of the most important pieces, Harry helped us work on this. This comes from the advisory council. It was almost 2 years in being crafted and comes as a direct result of the storm season of 2004, is that there is a new provision in the act granting emergency powers to the board of directors in times of a declared emergency, both to prepare the community for the approaching storm, Tropical Storm Fay, Hurricane Fay, help mitigate damage after the storm passes. Make yourself familiar with it, be aware of it, and actually when Paul and Lou are here talking about insurance, one of the obligations you have is helping to mitigate the damage as board members, and this language helps accomplish that objective. Two additional thoughts on that. One, make sure you're consulting with your local emergency officials when you're engaged in these powers. I would also commend to you, you'd be talking with association counsel to make sure you're implementing them correctly in these emergency powers. But the new emergency powers provision are a very good part of this bill. Next group of changes relate to the eligibility and standards of conduct for all of you that serve as members of the Board of Directors or desire to serve as members of the Board of Directors. The first change you will find in 718.111, and there is a new paragraph subsection that describes in some length the fiduciary obligations and what it means and how you will make your decisions under the law. It can look a little ominous, but guess what? It really is what the law has always been. It has been condensed and paraphrased in the Condominium Act so that you will be aware of it and anybody who wishes to be on the board will understand the standards of conduct they must engage in. These standards had previously existed in the not-for-profit corporate law and they have simply been brought over to the Condominium Act and included. One of the bad changes, this is my opinion, is that we have eliminated staggered terms for boards. I personally think continuity is a good thing. Through some aggressive effort, we were able to modify this provision before it finally passed. So you may have staggered terms as long as they are not longer than 2 years, and your community is authorized to have them in the bylaws and that it has been subsequently approved by a majority vote. So if you have staggered terms, the law is going to impact you pretty significantly on October the 1st. Please be aware of that. There's a new provision that, quite honestly, is a good idea and poorly written. And it provides that board members, or candidates for the board in this case, must certify that they have read their documents, read the law, read the rules of the division, and made their best effort to understand them. I think it's a pretty good idea, actually. It'd be a good idea if you knew what you were doing. Unfortunately, this is required to be done when you apply to run for office. The concept that Harry had actually brought to the legislature from the working group provided that after you got elected, you got 30 days to read your documents, read the law, and understand what you've gotten yourself into, and then sign a certificate that you had done so. And we had actually provided that correction to this bill in House Bill 679. That was the one that was vetoed. So the correction never occurred. I hope it will change in the 09 session, Senator Altman. But be aware that if you're running for the board, or if you've got candidates or helping candidates run for the board, there's a new form that they must be signing after October the 1st when they return their candidate information sheet. The bill adds some additional sanctions for board members who do not conduct business of the association as the law requires. It authorizes the division to remove you from office if you violate the law. And finally, it deems that if you are a board member and you are delinquent in your association assessments for 90 days, you have deemed to abandon the office of board, as a board member, and the remaining board members will fill the vacancy because of your delinquency. If you are a unit owner seeking office and you are delinquent, you are not eligible to run for the board. So, changes in standards and eligibility for board members. Record keeping and record access was also dealt with extensively in this legislation. First, I think the law appropriately now expands the amount of records that may be treated as confidential. So if records you have in the association contain Social Security number, driver's license number, credit card numbers, and other personal information of that nature, it is privileged and not subject to anybody just coming to change, I think, by the legislature. There are new civil penalties, not criminal, but civil penalties, personally, for board members and officers who intentionally destroy records. We would never do that. Or fail to keep records correctly. So, you want to make sure you know what the specific obligations are for record keeping, how it's done, and then do it correctly so that you do not face both sanctions of removal by the division or financial penalties that could be imposed by the division for failure to do that. Like the meetings, records must now be kept within 45 miles of the community. So if you've got a management company that's assisting you, they can't be moving those records more than 45 miles from the community or within the boundaries of the county. That's specifically added for Monroe County because it's 45 miles. I mean, it's much longer than 45 miles from one end of the Keys to the other. And finally, in records, there is now a requirement, not an option, but a requirement that the division must issue a subpoena on behalf of a unit owner requesting records when the association has failed to produce the records after two written requests. The division will issue a subpoena and require that the records be produced for the unit owner. A couple of items regarding financial operations, let me mention those. We have been required for years, depending on the size of our budget and annual financial report, to provide an audited or compiled or reviewed financial statement at year end by a CPA. The law also provides that that may be waived by communities, and I think many do. That waiver privilege has now been stopped at the end of a three-year period. You may only waive for 3 years, then you must prepare the report or have the report prepared by a CPA as the law requires based on the size of your community. If you're engaged in a special assessment procedure, there are some additions, and your notice is required to be a bit more descriptive than previously done. As I mentioned earlier, there is a new conspicuous type disclosure statement required when reserves are waived. There is now a new requirement that if a board member or officer has any financial interest, direct or indirect, in a contract or a party that is contracting with the association, the lawn service, pest control, whatever, it must be disclosed. And once disclosed, the board may still enter into the contract, but at the next meeting of the membership can cancel the contract if they want to. So if you have any type of financial interest between board and contracting parties, make sure you're aware that there are one, new procedures, and two, the contract is subject to cancellation. And finally, while I think most good communities probably were doing this at minimum anyway, the law does now require that before you lien a unit, you must give 30 days prior written notice to the delinquent unit owner before the lien is filed. Harry, I'm a little concerned about time. We got quite a ways to go, so if I am going too long or you need me to truncate it, wave your hand and I will do so. And I say to all of you, too, if you get tired of me, just go, Pete, that's enough. A few more changes that I will try to quickly go through in this bill. There are some changes affecting the modification of the condominium property. I mentioned the solar panels, which appeared in another bill. Well, there are actually some in this one as well. Same section of the law, 718.113. And it does extend the right to install not just hurricane shutters, but other hurricane protection devices. Unit owners and board members can do it. There's also a clarification in this area on who pays for what. So if you're considering hurricane protections or hardening of your building, insurance term, hardening of the building, there are some new options as a result of this bill. One final change. This runs comes directly from an anecdotal example that occurred down in Miami. The bill provides that a unit owner may display a religious object in the front door area of the condominium unit not to exceed 3 inches in width, 6 inches in height, and 1.5 inches in depth, notwithstanding provisions in the documents or policies of the board to the contrary. Also in the bill, some concepts that originated with folks here at Space Coast, particularly Harry and Clay and some others that are in the bill, not necessarily in the version they agreed with, but I think some good ideas that have surfaced in addition to the ones I've already mentioned. If you are in a building of 3 stories or more, you must now, every 5 years, have that building inspected by an architect or an engineer as to the building condition, status of repair, etc. So there's now a mandatory obligation on boards to do a building inspection for the community if you are greater than 3 stories in height. The community may waive that the same way they can waive reserves, but the requirement is nonetheless there. In addition to that, for new communities making transition from developer to the unit owners, a similar report must be delivered to the residents from the developer on the condition of the building and its various components, remaining useful life, functionality, etc. That was not previously required, but that report is now to be included with all the other transition materials. And finally, there is going to be a new governance pamphlet prepared by the division to explain to every new unit owner the rights that they have, the nature of condominium living, and the responsibilities which they have to the community, to the association, and to help maintain its financial well-being. I expect in talking with the division director, we're going to see that here shortly. And again, I think all pretty good ideas. A couple of miscellaneous items that are also in this bill. There is the same requirement for receivership notice. If you cannot fill your board and a unit owner decides that he's going to get a receiver in there so that the association can continue to run, there are new notice requirements to all of the unit owners, and if the receivership is granted, the judge must also provide notice that that has occurred to all unit owners. This is identical to the provision that I previously discussed for homeowners associations that have passed in House Bill 1105. The anti-slap suit free speech protection component that's been in homeowners association law now since 2004 has been added verbatim to the Condominium Act. It prohibits the filing of slap suits against a unit owner, and if a suit is filed, it entitles the unit owner to cost recovery rights and sanctions against the person who did it. And finally, there are some pretty significant changes with regard to the division, in my opinion. As of October the 1st, the division no longer, the post-transition jurisdiction of the division has changed. So after the developer leaves the community and transition is complete, the division's jurisdiction is no longer broad-based in a residential condominium community. It is narrowed to include financial issues, elections disputes, and records access. Fat dogs and purple doors are gone. That, we think, allows for the division to focus on more serious problems. It quite honestly takes out of play, in my opinion, a lot of what is referred to as the frequent flyer, chronic complainer type things, and will focus them on the 3 key areas to protect unit owners. While restricting in some ways, the powers of the division have been expanded in others where it still has jurisdiction. As I mentioned earlier, the division now has the authority to come into the community, find a violation of the law by the board, and go, you're out, and remove the directors or officers. And while that removal order is in place, that person is not eligible to run if re-election occurs during that period of time. It also authorizes the division during the period of developer control and during transition or after transition to order restitution be made or to be made by a developer when there are deficiencies in funding or in an association account, so they have the expanded ability to order that restitution. A new program that I'm kind of excited about, because, of course, I'm preaching to the choir in this sense, is this new program allowing the division to certify education providers. Once certified, posted on the website, so if someone's interested, they can find out where to get more education about their community, how to lead their community. I would think on the top of the division's list, if you all are motivated to do it, is you would be submitting that Space Coast's programs would be part of the certified programs of authorized by the division to provide education to officers, unit owners, and members of the association about their communities. And the last change that sort of indirectly reflects relates to the division is that the ombudsman has been given a bit more power, because they may now, or the office of the ombudsman may now help in resolving disputes where the jurisdiction of the division no longer extends to those disputes. Okay, one more bill to go, and then we're ready to go to questions and answers. And the final year, final bill of significance in this year's session is committee substitute for House Bill 601. And if you look it up, this is a bill by Representative Hudson, brand new member of the legislature. He did his best, and I did a very good job passing the bill. But the truth of the matter is, a lot of what you find in this bill comes from Representative Altman and from Senator Jones, who handled the bulk of the duties in getting this worked out, cleaned up, and done right. And this bill also, very long, it's 152 pages in length. It provides for the reorganization and renaming of the division of, formerly known as Division of Florida Land Sales, Condominiums, and Mobile Homes, now known as Division of Condominiums, Timeshares, and Mobile Homes. And the land sales regulation has basically been offloaded to help the division operate more in the area where contemporary problems exist. You can disregard most of this long and lengthy legislation, because it really relates to the renaming and the changing of this jurisdiction, so don't pay a lot of attention to it. Other than the fact you want to know about the new name change, because if you're going to be writing Mike Cochran or John Pete or whatever, I think you probably want to get their titles correct. But there are some substantive changes that relate to condominium operations. Let me touch on them briefly. Harry, is there some water? Gary, just a little bit. I apologize. There are clarifying provisions to Section 718.115. This is what mandates what is a common expense. And we have had over the last number of years, simply because it becomes practical to do, government-mandated fire protection, water meter, master water meters, and things of that nature. Thank you, Jackie, very much. And when these government-mandated improvements are required in your community, they are deemed to be a common expense for everybody to pay for. This basically overrides a prior decision by the division. Now, I don't like, obviously the legislature didn't like what the division was doing, but I think the division got boxed into that because of the way the law was written, and they just simply had to follow the law. That has now changed, and those now become common expenses. There are provisions that modify termination. Hopefully this will not affect you, but it basically protects the rights of every unit owner to get back in cash what their unit was worth, and not let a lender come over from another unit and go, oops, there wasn't enough money there to satisfy that mortgage, so now I want some of yours. Can't do that. The bill revises the process for providing estoppel certificates. I talked about this earlier for homeowners associations. Same changes for condominium associations. But if you are doing this and allowing your management company to charge for it, make sure it's just not an understanding. It's got to be in writing, either in the management contract or by a written resolution adopted by the board. Again, the unit owner is responsible ultimately for the payment. It will be made at closing of either the loan or the sale. And if not, if the closings fall through, then when next month's assessment comes up, you're going to be paying the cost to provide that service. There was one change to the bill I discussed earlier, House Bill 995, that appears in this bill. I didn't mention it before because what it really does is restore the law to what it has always been, and it relates to the abstaining board member because of a conflict of interest. And basically says, if you abstain because you have a conflict of interest and are not voting, which, by the way, is the only reason you can abstain, the vote doesn't count. When it passed in Representative Urbina's bill, it was an automatic no vote. It's kind of silly. It didn't come from Representative Urbina. It came from another member, Representative Gibbons, who mistakenly got it in the bill, and we had to take it back out again. So there is a correction that we mentioned. Now, finally, and I've saved the more difficult and the most complex for last, there is a significant rewrite in House Bill 601 for 718, 111, 11, insurance. It's interesting, I was not aware of this when I was preparing my remarks, but two of the people who helped contribute to this before it went to the legislature were Paul Wien and Lou Byron. So it's very insightful that your next program will include them. I want to give a little bit of perspective as I lead into this, though, because I have had a number of questions. We've actually, I wrote to Senator Jones, who was the House sponsor, Senate sponsor of this, before I left yesterday afternoon, and I'm going to write to Representative Altman, soon to be Senator Altman, about this on Monday, because we have a couple of things that do need some clarification here. But I want to talk a little bit about the fact that this section of the law has been around forever, at least 25 years. And I think associations have generally overlooked it, not paid much attention to it, except for the fact that you were interfacing with your insurance agent once a year to buy the coverage. And if you ended up having a fire or other casualty, you were dealing in the recovery process until 2004. And during the storm season of 04 and 05, we got a whole new look at it. But prior to that time, the only people that were really paying attention to it were insurance agents, insurance companies, regulators, both DDPR, our division, and Office of Insurance Regulation, in trying to work out the mandates of what the Condominium Act required versus what was in the insurance code and was available. This section, during a period of 20 years, was amended more than any single section in the Condominium Act. And that obviously has not changed because it's undergone major revisions both in 2007 and in 2008. And I would additionally observe, based on some of the questions and comments that have arisen in the aftermath over the summer in this legislation, it is very apparent to me that this section, prior to its changes, was not understood very well at all by many communities, and that many communities were probably not complying with the law. So regardless of that history, the law is the law now. This is what we're expected to comply with. Let me see if I can walk you through the requirements briefly, and you will have the benefit of both Lou and Paul in a month. But regardless, let's look at what they are. First, most of what this change does is reformat it in a clearer way without making many substantive changes, although there are a few. The criteria of adequate insurance remains, but is clarified. It has always been considered, that is, adequate insurance standard, has always been considered by most, including the division, to be full replacement coverage. And if you didn't have it, you were not in compliance with the law. The law now very clearly states that that is the standard. We also conformed the language to require that same standard of the developer during the developer control period, because while everybody always thought it was the same, the words were different, and they are now identical. I want to acknowledge Senator Posey, because this is a very difficult burden to reach and is very expensive to get to unless you can be creative and where your deductible is supposed to be, and I'm going to get to deductible in a minute, and also find other options that work because they are unique to condominium communities. And much appreciation to Senator Posey for helping us accomplish much of this in 2007, and then again this year along with Representative Altman's help. There are two additional programs that were created in 2007. One's called a SIF, Self-Insurance Fund. I'm aware of only three that have been created in Florida so far, and only one of those three that's being viably operated. And also pooled insurance, where there are, I think, as many as 79 policies outstanding in some parts of Florida. I do not think there are any here. The only change to this part is to require that the pooled insurance option now must be approved by the Office of Insurance Regulation in the same way that the self-insurance fund should that must be approved. Now, these are sort of exotic products that probably, well, let me say, we'll leave that to questions if you have them. I want to come to the next part of coverage. Full insurance means from $1 to $10 million. Full replacement coverage, you have to be able to pay it all. No policies ever have that. There's always some self-insurance component, in my experience, in the package. And what's the one that we all have? The deductible. The standard in the law has always been reasonable deductible. Anybody want to take a guess what that is? Anybody want to ask their lawyer to opine what that is? Somebody said it, and I want to comment, that up until the 2007 and 8 changes, it probably would have been considered at most a couple thousand dollars would have been the reasonable deductible, because that had been the standard prior to the 2004 storm. Do you think in 2005 you could have bought a policy with a deductible of $2,000 for a $10 million building? You could buy it, but you can't afford it. And so it's like automatically every board member in Florida in a condominium is in a breach of duty because they can't follow the Condominium Act in order to get insurance. Well, thank you to our legislature to immediately address that in special session and give us these options. Reasonable deductible now has some criteria to guide it. When making this decision, board members, you may consider the cash you have on hand. Think about it. The roof. I've been reserving for 20 years for a 25-year roof. I have hundreds of thousands of dollars in the bank to replace that roof. Cash. Condominium Act says I still have to insure it 100%. Doesn't necessarily make sense. You might want to, because you may want to save that money, but it seems to me you may want to consider the fact that, oh, I have this amount of money, so I certainly don't have to pay for insurance to cover it. That is now an option for the board. You might have other cash on hand also option. Your predetermined assessment authority. We can save a lot of money. We think it's a prudent business decision if we decide today that we're not going to, and by the way, the most expensive insurance is for the first part of the loss. That's what you pay the most for. So if you're self-insuring that part, you're probably saving what you're paying QBE or Travelers or whoever you're buying your insurance from. Sorry, lost track while I was trying to tell my story here. I got too animated, I guess. The second thing you can do as a board is use your predetermined special assessment authority. That is, if we have a disaster, we're gonna assess everybody $2,000. And I'll get to the reason for that in a minute. And so we're gonna base our deductible on that, combined with our cash on hand. And now I have a very reasonable deductible because I have a different way to raise that money and I don't have to pay an insurance company to give it to me. Second criteria. Third criteria is that you may look to deductibles that are the prevailing industry standard and practice. And if you look at that context of the storm seasons that have brought us to this point, standard practice in the industry prior to 2004 was one thing and very quickly spun on its ear and was something totally different. leaving board members paralyzed using the business judgment rule to meet their fiduciary responsibility in a standard that was no longer available in the marketplace. So some pretty significant changes in what is considered a reasonable deductible, that is, the portion the board elects to self-insure. One other thing, and I also think this would have already been the law before it appeared in this section in 2008. When you make the decisions that I just described, including buying the policy itself, you must notice that board meeting 14 days in advance, written notice to everybody in the community. And why would that be? I'm considering a special assessment. And we already had in the law a requirement that if you're considering a special assessment, you must describe what it is, give the 14-day written notice, and implement it that way. But I think when people were buying insurance over the last couple years, well, I won't put anybody on the spot, but when you were setting your deductible, were you sending that notice out? Didn't think so. Well, you should have been. Now the law will make it very clear how you approach this problem. Now, if you're doing it in a very prudent and well-organized manner, what you're going to end up doing is you're going to make this decision the same time you do your budget. And what's the notice requirement for a budget? It's exactly the same. So there's a very easy way to integrate it all, but what we were finding is boards were making these huge decisions. We're taking a $500,000 deductible, which means, oh, by the way, everybody's going to get assessed $2,000. But they just did it in the board meeting. Didn't give any notice to the unit owners. And board members, you don't want to do that because the first thing somebody's going to do is go, they shouldn't have done that. I'm suing you. You want to avoid that. You want to go through the steps the right way and make sure you've done the coverage correctly. Okay, so we're done with deductibles. Let me talk about individual insurance coverage. And this is going to be one of the difficult trouble spots that I think will still need to be polished by the legislature in 2009. We now have provided specific enforcement mechanisms to make sure every unit owner has unit owner insurance. Now, that's always been the law since 2004, but there wasn't any way to enforce it. Now there is. The bill also provides that every HO6, that's the unit owner, that's the insurance world's term for the individual homeowner unit owner's policy, must include special assessment coverage in the amount of $2,000. So, if you experience casualty loss and you find it necessary to assess the unit owners in your community, $2,000, State Farm, Travelers, USAA, Nationwide, must have in their policy coverage to reimburse the unit owners that $2,000. Now, I will say that many of the large companies have that in their HO6 already. It's either $1,000 or $2,000. Others didn't have it at all. I think the legislature made a good choice by saying, look, this is a big deal. Catches people by surprise. Casualty disasters are very disruptive. Let's make this uniform. Let's make it available. Let's then also allow boards to use it in the planning for the selection of their deductible. Remember when I was talking about deductible could be based upon predetermined assessment authority? Well, board members, you now know that after January the 1st, every policy is going to have special assessment coverage in it. You can make that decision knowing that your unit owners should have bought the policy coverage and should have that available, no harm, no foul. There's some new language that talks about the repair and construction of the components after a casualty loss. Candidly, that is what the law would have required already in other parts of the Act. And then we get to an unrelated item that where the main changes to insurance do require, and that is to overrule, at least in part, a decision by... We've got to change things. You want to do it now? Because okay. If you'll give me a break, but we're also, I'm about done, so. Everybody got your questions ready? Okay, ready to go? Real quickly, this will take 2 minutes or less. The final part of the insurance changes that we find in 718.111 are the provisions that override the division's declaratory statement in a case called Plaza East. I won't bog down on what that did, except it created a mess, particularly with regard to negligence. What the bill does is restore the doctrine of negligence that has always existed before this mess was created by the division. So, if a unit owner negligently causes damage to a neighbor or to the common elements, the unit owner is responsible for his or her negligence. The second thing that this language does is it allocates the responsibility to repair based upon the responsibility to insure unless your community decides to change that in some form or fashion, which they may now do by reflecting it in their documents. So you have either automatically the responsibility to cover, to repair the property and pay for the cost of repair and pay the deductible for that which you must insure, or you may provide alternatively for it in your documents. Now, I think we may have some questions on insurance, and I'll leave the rest of that till later. One of the things that I would encourage you to consider is you want to be working with a very good insurance professional in dealing with some of these issues, and probably your association counsel as well. A lot of material. I apologize for talking quite so long. I'm done. Thank you for your attention. If there are questions, or I guess there aren't any, I'll be glad to answer them. But why don't we get, Harry's got them. I see him now. Okay, good. Okay, first question is, actually, there are two questions. Let me do the first one first. If the division only deals with financial issues, records disputes, and election disputes, where would a unit owner go to complain about the board not following the law or maintaining the property? Let me make a couple of observations here. The question isn't clear to this extent to me because financial issues, records disputes, and election laws disputes are the law. So to the extent that the question implies differently, that the division still does have jurisdiction, and you really have to categorize these things factually. But having said that, if it cannot be categorized into one of the three categories, then you will be in mandatory non-binding arbitration, as all disputes or the other disputes were previously available to. That's an alternative dispute resolution mechanism that's been with us in condominiums since 1991. I think it works quite well. The success rate is over 95%, and that is the alternative you would use. Can a board member abstain, even though there is no conflict of interest, just to keep the vote from being passed? Well, I don't care what the reason is. If you're a board member, if you're in the room, and you don't affirmatively declare yourself a no, or declare an abstention because you have a conflict, you're a yes vote. So the answer to this is absolutely, board members are not supposed to be playing this game. That's the kind of thing that leads to a breach of fiduciary duty. Are board members grandfathered in their terms? Director was elected last year for a 3-year term. Are they allowed to stay in for the final 2 years? Do all board members have to run in 2008? This is not a new question. There's quite a bit of discussion going on. I think this advice, by the way, whoever asked this question, this advice is worth exactly what you're paying for it. I think that the law is not to to be applied retroactively. In order to do that, the legislature has a specific way to do it, and it was not done in this case. So my general feeling is, if you're in the middle of one of these things, you can't take a right previously granted away. That is, you know, you're halfway through your term. And that probably the not all members have to run in 08, but all who begin running in 08 will be under the standards of the new law, unless you change your documents, get a majority vote, and then your staggered terms may be two-year terms. Doesn't appear to address three-year term of directors, which we have in our bylaws. Does our right to contract supersede our new laws? Well, I can tell you candidly, Representative Urbina fully intends to override your documents. The idea that you may have a vested contract right in three-year terms is a very good legal argument. Is it worth $25,000 or $30,000 to run that through the appellate court system? But it is a good legal theory. Path of least resistance, in my opinion, would be two things. I think those of us that work in the area, I really don't want to be overly confrontational with Representative Urbina because I'm going to have to work with him again this year, but he is in his last term after he gets elected this time. I think in a couple of years this may change back to a more reasonable alternative, or simply move from three to two, and that way you don't have to fight the battle, but you might win that lawsuit if you want to pursue it in that way. But I think short of getting a judge to tell you it's okay, you got a problem. You got a problem. In order to continue staggered terms of 2 years, tenure board, does the board have to also conduct a membership vote if staggered terms are in the bylaws already? The answer to that is yes, you must do both. Condo installed shutters in 2006, I assume that means hurricane shutters, which were paid for through assessment by the unit owners. They are limited common elements, and the condo pays for the maintenance. Prior to the storm, the board asks all owners to lower their shutters. An owner refuses to do so. The board sustains damage as a result of this unit not being protected. Can this owner be asked to pay for damages to his unit, to the common elements, or to other units that might otherwise be paid for by the master association policy? I will tell you this is a complicated and sticky legal question. Let me give you as simple an answer as I can. Yeah, that unit owner now has big problems because when the new law took effect, reversing the Plaza East decision I talked about, I think this unit owner is now negligent as a result of his refusal. And because he was negligent and the damage ensued, he is responsible or she is responsible for the damage that resulted. One other thing I might mention in this regard. The Robina bill, which takes effect on October the 1st, has those emergency powers I was talking about. He can actually now order people out of the building, shut down the electricity, turn off the water, and the board can have an agent go in and shut all the shutters. So there are some new tools here to deal with. Now, obviously, that is a very big step, particularly against an owner who's being resistant or the one that won't leave. You will need help from association council and probably local emergency management officials. But for the benefit, one of the things that I think we all know is when you have a storm approaching and damage may occur, you want to shut off the water. You want to shut down the electricity because if something happens to those systems, pipes break, you've got flooding, you've got compounded damage that was not caused by the storm event itself. Electrical could cause fires. So the new emergency powers allow actually the shutdown, full shutdown of the building, including evacuation. And by the way, not letting people back in until you say it's okay while you're mitigating damage. Rain got into a unit causing damage to the sheetrock and the carpet of the unit owners. Who pays for the humidifier and who pays to investigate for possible mold? I'm going to answer this one, but I want to caution. There probably are some others like this. Don't walk out of here and go, hey, Dunbar said. Now, I think I'm pretty much right with what I'm doing, but you need to make sure you're getting good guidance from both your insurance carrier and your own counsel on some of these. And I don't know exactly what the facts are when you pose them in a question, and a missing fact might change some of the result. Having said that, this one's going to be, I think, the association's responsibility, because that's what Plaza East is. Now, the carpeting may be the owner's responsibility. However, remember I talked about the division of who's responsible for what? The law said last year and the year before and the year before and going forward that the master policy of the association will ensure everything that's common property plus those things in the unit as originally installed. So the wild card here for me is the carpeting and whether it's an upgrade or whether it's part of the original installation or not. But otherwise, I think this is going to be the association's responsibility. I love this one. I knew I'd get good. Discuss the exclusion of air conditioner as a unit owner expense and not a common expense or contracts. Oops, there's a second question here. Are contracts at purchase made the unit owner responsible? Okay, let me see if I can get this. Discuss the exclusions of air conditioners as a unit owner expense. Re a common expense are contracts at the purchase made the unit owner I think it means unit owner responsible. And again, this probably needs a little bit of legal guidance from your community because it is a contract interpretation and a contract of the law. And there is this theory that there's been a change in how we deal with air conditioning units. I personally don't agree with that. Well, I do agree with it in part because what we've done is the absolute mandate to put it in one category only has been eliminated from the law. So now you will decide whether insurance and responsibility for that goes to the association or to the individual unit owner based on whether or not it is defined as personal property of the unit owner. If it is, it's their responsibility. If it's not, it's going to be the association's responsibility. Part of the difficulty with this one, much like the building we're in, is that structures vary widely, and it was, I think, the legislature's view, and I agree with this, that you can't mandate that insurance is all in one place or the other. I stayed here last night, and in my room, I had my own air conditioning. But if you're in this complex of rooms, there's one system serving it all. That's not unlike what you find in a condominium structure, depending on what kind of structure it is. They may be individual, or they may be association. The law now requires the decision to be made in that context. If our documents have already been ended with a vote of the membership to have staggered terms, are we required to have another vote of the membership this year? Yes. If so, does it have to be before the annual meeting of the unit owners? In my opinion, it can be at the same time. When a unit owner requests official records by email rather than by certified mail, is the board obligated to respond to providing the unit records? No. By the way, the fact that you don't have to do it and that doesn't trigger the sanctions doesn't mean I wouldn't consider doing it just as a courtesy. Interestingly enough, and I've got maybe should look at this a little closer, they must ask by certified mail. You can respond by making it available electronically. But no, the trigger to actually begin the enforcement mechanism requires certified mail, as I understand the law. Does the condo board have the authority to use the pooling for method for reserves rather than the straight line method without owner approval? Yes, as long as the pooling meets the standard of the division's rules and the reserves are considered full reserves. You may use the pooled method as opposed to the straight line without a unit owner vote. If two owners in a condominium unit say that one person is disabled and covered by the ADA, does the governing board of directors have the right to know the name of the individual in the unit who is actually entitled to the rights and privileges covered under the ADA Act? I would think yes, but there's obviously more to this question that I don't know about, but I think the answer would be yes. If by December the annual operating expense budget is under budget by $10,000, can the board decide, vote to take those operating savings and make a one-time extraordinary payment into the reserve accounts? So if you have money left over, can you do it? Yes, you may. You may use it for that purpose. You may use it to reduce the forward year's reserves. The forward year's assessments. You can proportionally show it as a reduction in assessments going forward. Does the new law, 718.112.2d1, mean that we have to change our bylaws by having majority vote of the unit owners? I assume this is the staggered term question. It doesn't say it. And I think I've answered that already, so it's a majority vote, not a two-thirds vote, as you amend. Now, there are potentially two votes here. If staggered terms are not in your bylaws and you have to put them in there and it requires two-thirds, then you're going to have a two-thirds vote and then a majority vote. Under what condition is the association responsible for the damages done to a unit? That was answered in the last 30 minutes of my formal remarks. And it is dependent on the nature of the damage, how the documents are written, and who caused the damage. What is the status on a submerged land lease fee structure? What is the status on the submerged land lease fee structure? I assume somebody's got a dock. We have had some recent changes, but I'm not aware of any current ones. I don't understand the question. Let me say it that way. If somebody wants to come back to that, I'll try to readdress that. Who has the maintenance responsibility for the seals around the windows or doors? Under the current status of the law, would be my general feeling, in a standard community, again, depends on how your condominium is put together, but I assume this is for a mid-rise, high-rise, those are probably the responsibility of the association. Now, let me restate that. That may be the responsibility of either the association or the unit owner, depending on how the documents occur. If it's repair after a casualty loss, it's clearly the association. But if it's upkeep and maintenance, it could be as the documents define. And as I mentioned, the bill this year does allow you to go in and clarify your documents on that point if you choose to do so. Thank you, Representative Allred. Who has the responsibility to replace windows and doors after a catastrophic loss? Same answer to the same question. Similar question. Who has the responsibility to replace old windows and doors? Same answer. Does the 718 three-year developer warranty on mechanical and electrical systems apply to pool equipment and mechanical and electrical components? Yes, it would. Well, there are actually two parts of warranty that may be involved here. That one may be included. Some of this may be included as a manufacturer's warranty in lieu of the developer warranty that's being referred to in the question, and it may vary. It may have lapsed or not lapsed, and you also may have some common law warranties as well as the statutory warranties affected. Our condominium received a certificate of occupancy in August of 2006. Our pool equipment was recently destroyed by a fire caused by an electrical component failure. Do we have a claim against the developer for our insurance deductible of $5,000. You might, but the elapsed time here, one, when you made transition, there was a burden on the board of directors to have, in my opinion, determined at that time the completeness of the transition documentation and the status and condition of the buildings and improvements and electrical and other equipment that handled it. So, assuming you did it the right way, I would go back then to that report that was done for you at the time of transition to determine the status of this particular equipment. Now, if you didn't do the report, as a board, you probably didn't do all that was expected of you. And I would think 3 years after the fact, you got a real problem trying to make this claim. Legally, you might. It exists out there as a matter of law. Actually carrying this burden and doing it, I'd say check with your own lawyer. But I'd say unless you had that report done, you got a problem. Okay. Personal information with records release. Under the new section protecting owners, personal information and condo records, Social Security, etc., does the board withhold the entire record or must it redact the projected information and release the rest of the record? It's a good question, and I would think if the records do not fall into the category of the personal protected identifying information, that is, you would probably have the obligation to redact the privileged information and then release the records. I don't think we know yet full guidance on this from the division, but redacting may be the appropriate way to handle it. I would recommend that you would be asking counsel, here's what's being asked for, how should we handle, and rely on the advice being given. That way you've met your fiduciary duty, you're not subject to any sanctions by the division, and you get the answer to the question you're looking for. Are all unit owners required to have hurricane shutters? All have the right to have them. All must not have them unless you as a board decide that you want them to all have them. If they don't, can the board install them and charge the owner? Yes. And that's all covered in the new law. You might want to look on how that occurs and the steps that you need to go through to get that done. And then who pays for it once that occurs. For the 5-year inspection requirement for condos 3 stories in height, who is the first? When is the first inspection required if the condominium is older than 5 years or has never had an inspection? I gotta look that one up, and it's kind of funny because we've just finished the new addition to the book, and I dealt with this question, but I'm pretty sure it's got to be right now or within the next year. And you might actually, if you have the new law available to you, it does address that issue. And actually, let me put that aside. I'll come back to it when we get through these questions. How long can a bank take to handle a foreclosure? As long as they want. We are now in the 10th month waiting for the bank to take over. Can the association place a lien on the foreclosed property? Yes. 30 days notice now required. For additional special assessments? Yes. Also, is the bank required to pay for the unit electricity? I guess if they own the unit. Whoever the owner is probably responsible for it. Since the electricity has been turned off, no, they don't. I wouldn't think. Why? Do we have a mold problem here? This one's sort of interesting. We're having this experience throughout Florida. Banks do not have a requirement to move forward on any given timetable. However, if they do not move forward quickly, the accrued assessments, if you've got a lien and if you are protecting your rights, they ultimately become responsible for it, because when the foreclosure is complete, they are limited on how much of the assessments can be wiped out. So if you find yourself in this circumstance, you should be working with counsel to make sure you've protected yourself. You can also, in some occasions, depending on what the mortgage amount is, get in foreclosures first, take subject to the bank, and then try to resell and protect it all, including the profit. So a lot of these will be fact dependent. If you got one that's mortgage is 120% of value, you're just going to go, I don't want that one. But if it's one where the circumstances are different, you may want to make a different business choice. Our condominium complex is designed as 55 or over under the Federal Housing Act. The association documents state that all units have an over 55 resident instead of the 80% as the federal law requires. Unfortunately, we have two units that are occupied by residents that are 40-something. One person inherited the unit 4 years ago, and the previous property manager and board allowed the new owner to move in. Now we have a similar situation. Where's the question here? Can we now enforce this rule and ask the new person to move, or has the precedent been set by the previous 4 years of non-enforcement? It's really the question really sort of, the question doesn't relate to the fact pattern necessarily. I assume the question really is, can we protect our 55 or older status? Not can we make somebody get out? Or at least that's what the question should be, I think. And the answer is, yes, you can. The fact that you have two units, said differently, what I would be seeking to accomplish here is trying to make sure I had preserved and protected the federal standards so I could protect my right to do that. And I would be looking, this idea that we let somebody in contrary to what the documents permit is classic. And you have now stubbed your toe big time in the community, not you personally who asked the question, but you, the board or whatever management company, to let this occur. But I'm not sure that's the objective of what these restrictions are. And when the documents were written, it may have been, but today the Federal Fair Housing Act permits a 55 or over community, provided that 80% of the units or greater are occupied in this fashion. So, I think this problem can be cured. I'm not sure you can successfully cure it by trying to evict one unit owner after you've already permitted the other unit owner to be there for 4 years. I think that's a dead loser. Let me hold this one up. I'm not going to take the audience's time to read this, because if there is a specific question here, I'll be happy to do it, and I'll be happy to talk with you after the meeting about it, but I, in fairness to everybody else, I don't think we can go through that narrative and predicate. Harry, are there any more? Thank you. I'm the president and feel we should check each unit for damage after this storm. The vice president holds the keys and feels we don't have the right to enter units. How do we proceed? Vice President obviously wasn't part of the text message that everybody, Obama sent to everybody this morning, I guess. That's, one, this is neither the Vice President or the President's decision. Whose is it? Thank you very much. So, board meeting will decide. In my opinion, it is perfectly appropriate, if you have reason to believe that there may be damage, to enter those units. Now, if there's somebody in the unit, you just kind of knock on the door and go, have you experienced any damage? We'd like to look. But if the unit's occupied by someone who's off somewhere else, go in there and make sure that it is okay. That, to me, is perfectly appropriate. Just anecdotally, there is a case that occurs of this, and my mother lives in a condominium. And she said to me several years ago, they want a key to my unit. I don't want to give it. What can I do? I went, Mom, you don't have to give them the key. But if they have have a legitimate reason to be in that unit after Tropical Storm Fay to inspect for damage, and you're not there to let them in, they're going to break down the door, they're going to enter anyway, and you're going to be responsible for installing a new lock. So deal with it any way you wish, and I think that's probably the standard here. But I think it is appropriate that you would be entering if you have reasonable belief. I mean, you just can't do this at random. But if, I mean, we've had a pretty good storm, and all you got to do is walk around here in this complex, and you can see all the dryers going around and stuff like that. So, okay, how do they plan on enforcing the HOA coverage, HO6 coverage? That is the individual unit owner coverage. I'll tell you what, in the law, it now permits you as the board to go, okay, every unit owner in the building, by November the 1st, I want a certificate that you've, or a copy of your policy. You don't produce it, I'm going to go buy it, just like the bank would in a mortgage, and I'm going to charge you for doing it. So the ability to enforce it is in the law now, and it's pretty severe. I'm not sure I'm encouraging everybody to do that yet, but it is definitely there for you to go through, and there are specific steps that you have to go through to accomplish that, but you can do it. If we have 100 units with each unit having an HO6 coverage of $2,000 assessment coverage, do you really essentially have a $200,000 deductible? Yeah, that's the idea. That's exactly what the legislature was trying to afford and give us a better way to do it. Because that first $200,000 is what costs the most when you walk into the Travelers or QBE or whoever is your surplus lines carrier, if that's who it is. That first part of damage is what is the most expensive to buy. So, yes, but as I mentioned earlier, there are steps you must go through as a board to properly do that. Quite honestly, those steps have always been in the law, actually over in the bylaw provision 718.112.2. They have now been clearly laid out for you in the insurance provision, so you can do it. How can the association collect past due delinquent monthly maintenance fees from a financial organization that has taken over ownership through foreclosure in the same way you do from every unit owner? The property is in the midst of a lengthy foreclosure process. How do you collect it then? Then you want to make sure you've gone through your protecting steps with a lien, and the law will provide at what breakpoint the foreclosure will wipe out your claims or portions of your claims, and what portions will be paid. And you probably have the burden to look into the situation enough to know whether you should be ahead of the foreclosure process to protect it all by foreclosing first. The question concludes, in both cases, suppose the past due extends over several years. If you have let a unit owner in your community be delinquent for more than 90 days, board members, much less several years, you are in breach of your duty, in my opinion, to your neighbors and those who place you in fiduciary responsibility. I understand the mentality. I don't want to be suing my neighbors. Then don't run for the board. You have a mandatory affirmative obligation under the law and under your documents to make sure everybody meets their responsibilities to the concept. They're supposed to be paying and paying on time. And after a reasonable period, you have to use the rights and the enforcement mechanisms that are in your documents and in the law. And if you fail to do your duty, in my judgment, you are in breach. And for what it's worth, I do periodically give a speech on fiduciary responsibility. There are three cases that have been decided in Florida's appellate court on breach of fiduciary duty by board members. They involve different fact patterns. One of the fact patterns is the board failed to collect the assessments from unit owners, or some unit owners in this case. Lawsuit filed, board members lose, put your money on the table. Personal responsibility for not doing your duty. So, the fact pattern here, that is, they haven't paid for over several years, never should happen in the first place. I don't mean to overstate it, but you need to be doing your job correctly, particularly under these new penalties and sanctions that are there. And they're pretty clear. And if somebody goes, hey, don't do this to me, it's like, I don't have a choice. Actually, in most communities, I think, probably go, management company, when it happens in a certain automatic way, begin the process. Or lawyer, begin the process. And that way you can go, look, it's in the board resolution. It was adopted 3 years ago. It happens automatically. You didn't pay, you get leaned. That's the rules. That's the law. With that, those are all the questions. And as always, I've enjoyed being with you again today. Thank you, Harry. And thank all of you. Yeah, absolutely. Oops, I need to be unmiked, I guess, since I feel like I'm wired up here. Can I answer that on the air? The new book manuscript went to the publisher about 10 days ago, and the new book should be out about the same time the new law takes effect.